you so much for a wonderful panel there. We have one more panel, but I feel compelled to say one thing, which is one of the advantages of being old, which I am old, is that I remember directly analogous panels on GIS to AI, talking about how GIS will help and what it will do. And now we have way too much GIS. Anyway, for our final panel, go back to the header slide. Go back a slide. Did I hit advance? Okay, so our final panel, here we go. Our closing panel is on Into the Great Wide Open, what's been built, what are the possibilities, and where are we going? And we're very fortunate to have Terry Bush, one of the most senior and experienced practitioners of geospatial intelligence in the United States government, and now a leader in the field. And I'm going to have Terry come up and introduce his panel and lead it away. Take it away.
Come on up, guys.
Hey, everybody. It's mentioned. Terry Bush here. A pleasure to be here today. We know we're the last panel standing between you and happy hour. That's like the red trolley car standing between the San Diego Convention Center and the Gas Lamp District. We know what that's like, right, for those who've been to the Esri Fed UC. So we're going to try and be a little provocative and entertaining and engaging to make that time go quickly here today. I have the pleasure to introduce a panel that I have not had to be with before. Some of these folks I know well. But I'm going to start with Dan Pallone at the end from, right next to me here, this end, from Element 84. Dan has been at NASA for 15 years in the Earth Observation Unit there. Dan has taught graduate, undergraduate computer science. He's written books. We were joking earlier, we think he was a co-star in the movie The Martian. I don't know that there's anything he hasn't done. He's going to bring a wealth of experience to you. So I've known Dan for about 3 months. But watch this. Next, I'm going to introduce Eric Finnan. I've known Eric Finnan for 26 years. Eric is from National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. Eric is one of the best geospatial developers, investigators, researchers, figure-it-outers there ever was. He spent a good amount of time in industry before moving over to government. He works under the chief data officer there now. On big data and developing good open source solutions. So he's a perfect guy to have here today. He's one of my very good friends. Then we'll get to Chad. I've known Chad since 1993. We went to college together. We first met in something called the Spatial Data Analysis Lab. So long before the term data science was invented for geographers like us, Chad and I would spend our Fridays and Saturday nights figuring out spatial data in a tiny little room. Chad has been around government, mostly the intelligence community, as probably, in my opinion, our leading geodata scientist, narrative builder. The things he has figured out have gone to the theater, have gone to the White House, has more track record of producing great results and amazing narratives than any other geo person that I've met. Just quite an honor to be with Chad today, and it was an honor to work with these two for so many years. So that's the panel you have today. They have lots of history, lots of insights, so ping them hard. And that's what I'm going to try and unlock with these guys here today. I'm going to start, I'm going to start going back in time, right? To me, open source is a begat story, and I'm going to proselytize about it here today. We began in mid-2000s with some web map software that didn't perform very well. And then one day we decided and we figured out how to turn on a web map service and a web feature service. And the world beat a path to our door. Our servers became very popular and remained that way for a very, very long time. That begat story said, hey, wait a second here. The other part of that begat story is when we went to an open source solution, we reduced the size, cost, and scope of our stack, yet got more performance. And that was incredible for a fledgling little GIS shop at the Defense Intelligence Agency where I worked. So we'll sort of start with the panel there, and I think I'll start, Chad, with you. You know, sort of going back in time, what are your lessons learned coming from open source?
Yeah, so I think for me, is the mic? Mic sounds nice. Yep. I think for me, there was an epiphany moment. I came to the intelligence community. I wandered through graduate school, and I had a real job in Baltimore, found the intelligence community in 2005. By 2007, I was supporting a special operations customer. We were focused on a Horn of Africa mission. And although I had access to the raw intelligence, you know, SIGINT, all the classified things, in that part of the world, the data was not as rich as it could be. And I ended up finding the answer to an important and outstanding intelligence question on a Panoramio photo that was posted on Google Earth. And this is 2007. If you remember, Panoramio is not with us anymore. Rest in peace. It was to Instagram, basically, before there was Instagram. And in that photo, I found the answer to a question that, you know, I couldn't find in all of the exquisite collect and exquisite data. And I realized quickly thereafter that the open data sources had a lot to offer. And so I effectively made a career out of, and by the way, thank you, Terry, for overselling me. I'll try and be somewhere near what you sold me as. But I made a career out of taking these intelligence problems, taking the data we have access to on the high side, but usually finding the right answers, finding important information in open data sources. In 2011, by 2007, I was convinced, and I would tell anyone I could find, that OSINT was more than you think it is. I began working with Terry again. We were in college together, but we took a 10 or 12 year hiatus, and I joined him professionally at DIA. And we in 2009 joined there, but I brought with that open source mentality to that organization. And in 2011, Arab Spring happened. Open source told the story better than any data we saw through there. In 2014, it was Crimea, 2016 ISIL, and now I go to bed at night flipping through tweets of HIMARS strikes, and then I read about it at work the next morning, but I see it when there are seconds or minutes old out there. So I became I call it an open sorcerer at that point. You combine the data and a little bit of code, and I'm not much of a coder, but we'll talk about the GPTs later, but you combine those two together, and it really unlocked a lot for me. So most of what I do is on the high side, but the open source data is the key to almost every product or project we've done. So
great, thanks. I don't do anything with technology without asking Eric first. He vets everything I do. I won't buy a watch unless I talk to Eric first. So you have to understand. So Eric, this is a great question for you. So give us your lessons learned as the best technology researcher that we know.
Once again, also a little bit of a Terry upsell, but I appreciate it. Thanks. I'm going to give a 60-second chat answer first before I jump into that one. Spent a decade doing a lap as a contractor. Came into NGA, started doing disaster work, then started doing mobile app development. A lot of this was unclassified. It's a big, brave, unclassified world. Then I ran away for 4.5 years on a 2-year JDA to DIA with Terry and joined it, came back, Foundation Geo, and doing unclassified stuff there. So first off, I'm the token fed on the panel. Speak slowly, enunciate your words. And I'm gonna be at about 2/3 of what I normally am, just so work doesn't yell at me too much. Right, the first thing, institutional inertia is real, right? NGA is huge, NGA is gigantic. They have so many products, they have so many customers. And, earlier, grumpier Eric would have basically said, you're being stupid, you need to upgrade, you need to update these things. But I'm older, wiser, gentler now than I used to be, but right, people don't get the data. There's a lot of buttonology. People don't know why things are bad. We need to communicate with things, but a lot of times NGA is making products that are 20, 25 years old because that's what they're used to receiving, and more importantly, that's what the customer wants and needs, and they can't update their stuff that well in a timely fashion. So that part of the thing is kind of makes more hair fall out and turn gray and keeps me up at night because it could be optimized so well. You know, a chunk of the time it's NGA's fault because NGA is kind of slow, but more often than not, there's legacy and people are afraid to change because it's going to break something that's been working since the Clinton administration. And and it maybe if you have, you know, we've all used shapefiles and we all feel dirty when we use a shapefile, but there's other imagery and vector-based formats that are even more challenging and unique than a shapefile, right? That one's kind of ubiquitous, but I'm just kind of picking on shapefiles for fun. But yeah, it's slow to change. It's a giant cruise ship that's, you kind of have to point slowly and you have to show them why they're getting there and then just let it go and see what happens.
Great, thanks, yeah. VectorRome and RasterRome, if you ever use those, are still used today. Built by Jim Bellinger and Eric Schwartz in early 90s, I think. Dan, over to you. So NASA and NOAA and these civilian agencies, we think they're perfect. And the DOD side, you know, we suffer from, you know, a bounty of great budget, but not necessarily the best innovation center for tech in the world. What do you see as lessons learned from your side of the world?
No, I think you're right. They're perfect. Yeah. Okay, as a company, about half of our work is in the public sector and about half of our work on the commercial side. We started a lot of our commercial space, and when we started the commercial space side, we took a lot of the open source that we had built on the federal side and moved it over. And we hit a wall pretty fast. And this was code like we had written, so this is not throwing a rock at that code or anything along those lines, but what we learned pretty quickly was that there were like agency-isms baked into a lot of that code. And we believe in open source, and it forced us, or I'll say me, I don't want to drag anybody else down with me, it really forced me to look at kind of like, all right, how are we engaging in the open source world? And I think there's like three tiers of this. This was like the lesson learned for me. The first tier is like, it's a free software store. And you're like, sweet. And you just go grab the pieces that you want. Okay, cool. Nothing. No judgment. That's okay. All right. The second tier is like, you're contributing, right? So this is, you hear people like, oh, if you've got an issue, fix it. Okay, right? So you're contributing code back. You're maybe fixing a bug. Maybe you're adding a feature. Maybe you go all the way to you're contributing solutions back into that. And you're open sourcing some of your code base. Awesome. Okay, but the pro tier level is figuring out, and I'll use like hipster terminology, where the community influencers are and like what's happening, what's happening behind the scenes, what's driving these things, and where are they going? And it's really plugging into that is when all of a sudden like things accelerate. And there's like a corollary to this, which I would throw out is that if you're building something that has enough value to people, there's going to be a commoditization wave chasing you. And it's actually, I'll use the analogy from the last panel, right? You can either be on the bus, driving the bus, or hit by the bus. Like, if you're building something that truly has value, somebody else also has that problem. Somebody else is also building a solution. And it's basically, are you going to be part of that bigger movement and that commoditization and moving to new problems? Or are you going to be progressively left behind? And I'm going to keep coming back to this theme for a bit. But that was, you know, I think we could talk to this group. Like, I could ask, you know, a bunch of folks, hey, who's driving the open specifications? Like, if we say Stack, I imagine a lot of you are familiar with Stack. Okay, like, who would you talk to if you wanted to know where Stack was going? And you probably have some idea. Or what conference would you go to hear where Stack is going? Okay, you can plug in there. Or, you know, cloud-optimized point clouds, or cloud-optimized geotiffs, right? Like, if you're plugging into COG or COPSI or any of those, like, those are pretty big names. If you're using them, you probably know where to look. Who's doing this for GeoAI? Like, who's got the pulse of this? Where's that community happening? Or who's kind of steering, for lack of a better term, behind the scenes that then turn into Git repos that you clone or an open source project that you use or whatever it is?
Perfect, thank you. Yeah, I that's dead on how I think. I'm going to move on to the next question. And this is important to me because my career, I come in and out of GEO, right? I should have probably ended up in GEO at the end of my career, and I would get moved out and then move back in, and I get promoted well above my own level of competency. So the question in seeking that audience, like who is the GEO experts of today? It's you guys. What do you like today? What do we like that's out there today that you would implement right now that maybe I don't know about, right? Because I've been out of this for a couple of years. Chad, I'll start with you again.
Yeah, so, yeah, we hear a lot about AI, and, you know, that's kind of like saying big data or cloud. Like, you can define that however you like. There's a lot of flavors of it. The piece for me that really has impacted me the most is the code assist side of generative AI. I mean, we like to play with ChatGPT, ask it cool questions, philosophical ones, why am I here, you know. But turns out it also writes code way faster than your best coders. It will, you know, basically give you a force multiplying effect. And it, for me, someone that often doesn't code and for months at a time, and you know, comes back and I feel rusty, you know, writing a simple script is tough. Or even if I have been coding a lot, writing an advanced script is tough. I have to go to our Jedi Ninja guys and take them off their Jedi Ninja work to do something for me, and that's inefficient. The past, you know, few months, a year or so, the Gen AI code that is spat out for me keeps me away from bothering the high-end guys and makes me much more productive. You know, a few examples. One is the other day I needed just a quick visualization of all of the recent Ukraine activity. So ChatGPT, write me a leaflet script that maps over the occupied areas of Ukraine all of the events from the last week's bit of news. Use Live UA as the source. It took me 10 seconds to ask for it. It took it 10 seconds to write the code, 2 minutes to copy-paste it into a thing, and splash, I had had the web map going in seconds. It would have taken me a half a day to figure all that out. It would have taken our ninjas an hour or maybe less, but bottom line is suddenly I'm a coder again. And again, that takes, you know, that avoids me having to go to our higher-end guys and take them off the enterprise software that we're working on, the bigger stuff. One fun one recently was a colleague of mine had a pretty productive script, but it was heavily reliant, a Python script, heavily reliant on ArcPy. I don't have ArcPy available at home, so ChatGPT, convert this ArcPy script into a PyQGIS script. And it goes through and finds all the ArcPy commands, swaps them out for PyQGIS, even gets the syntax swapped out, and rewrote the script for me, and it ran on the first try. Like, by the way, it often fails the first try. It's an iterative process. But in one try, I suddenly had a script that would run on QGIS that would have taken me hours to rewrite and figure it out. And then, okay, open sourcers, what's the next move there? Can you write that script to do every script in this folder and convert them all from one to the other? And suddenly I had, you know, a half a career's worth of software that I could use at work where I have an ArcPy license, but now I can use it at home where I have QGIS. That would have taken me weeks, months to do. So Code Assist is a thing. If you're not leveraging it, I highly recommend it. I mean, if you're anything above entry-level coder, it'll bring you to the middle level. It'll bring your middle-level people to the top, and it'll keep the basic stuff off the shelves of your or off the inboxes of your hardcore dev. So Code Assist is what I like right now.
All right, Eric, over to you. What are you liking today?
All right, let me give you the disclaimer. Eddie didn't pay me to say this. PostGIS and Postgres are amazing, right? I had a project at my last gig at NGA playing with Foundation GeoInt data, looking at some, and as well, Carter didn't pay me to say this. I was even using a good chunk of Oak Ridge data to find latent demand scores, live data pipes, unclassified networks with numerous NGA data sets connecting with live data pipes to analyze stuff at scale quickly, figure out latent demand scores tied in with population and stuff like that. You know, when I first started playing with this tech, you know, it's an old joke, but it was like the free like puppy, free like beer, right? I think there's a whole lot of people at a lot of the agencies that are, you know, this is, I say this because also the happy hour is coming up. It's more free like beer now than it used to be, right? The care and feeding of this is not as bad. Documentation is great. People are contributing to it. If stuff doesn't make sense, it tends to get fixed in a nice, timely fashion, right? So, you know, some of the core functionality here is just amazing. I was proud because it was one of my projects, right? And then they pulled the funding on it. 6 months later, somebody else asked to try and bring it back, and I gave them the code. They're like, no, where's the Esri code on it? I'm like, yeah, no, right? And they're like, yeah, we can't do this. And I'm like, yeah, I know. We need to need to look at this a little bit differently, need to look at the data a little bit differently, but just the tool stack now is so much better than it used to be. It's impressive, and blow up the silos like they currently exist, especially at my agency, right? It just needs, throw it all in one place. You got the cloud, you got the compute, you got the data pipes for it. Like, and a lot of other folk are doing it. We should do it as well, because as soon as you're trying to grab things over country boundaries, COCOM boundaries, other things, it's really painful to grab data. But you can do cool things, and it worked nicely.
Gotcha. All right, so, yeah, I hear you loud and clear on that. And that's gonna, if we get time at the end, I wanna come back and open this up to you, all of you guys. This question of, if everything we need is sort of out there on OS, that challenges current state of a lot of our theology in geospatial. Dan, over to you. What are you liking today? And let's go big here.
Yeah, all right. So I was told I'm the hype man on the panel. So I'm going to start at the basics and then go big. So starting at the basics, it's the open cloud native geospatial data. Like, that is enabling all kinds of stuff. It's coming from a number of agencies. NASA's moving all of the DACs to the cloud, Landsat coming out of USGS. We maintain 30 petabytes of Sentinel data in AWS open data. There was a conversation earlier about Google's data inside of Earth Engine. There are hundreds of petabytes of open data out there that is ongoing, forward processing, actively, you know, being collected data out there. So that's like the foundation tier. Next step up, for me, it's the stack ecosystem. Like, it's, if you're not familiar, we're talking about metadata, you know, kind of, some people get excited about that, some people don't. But that's all right. The stack metadata and then the tooling around it, stack browser, stack fast API, all of the things that kind of basically enable access to that level of data, the petabytes of data that are sitting out there. Once you have those pieces, when you've got hundreds of petabytes of data sitting out there, free to access, available, you have a stack ecosystem sitting on top of it, which now gives us the interoperability to be able to get to it. It's cloud native. All right, so now take the commercial space side. All right, so you've got commercial space offerings that let us go from something like a globally collected, constantly updated Sentinel, you know, at its resolution, at its granularity, and I can now move into a world where I can tip and queue into a high-resolution collect for $1,000 of a SAR instrument or a high-resolution optical. And I can wire all of that together as just like somebody sitting at home. That's crazy. So now take it one step further and you start to get into the foundation model. So I'm gonna sound like Chad here and start talking about AIML, but like when we start talking about foundation models, so coming out of NASA Impact is the HLS, there's an HLS, they worked with IBM, produced a handful of foundation models trained off of harmonized Landsat Sentinel. There's a weather model out there. We're talking about foundation models that are trained on petabytes of actively collected geospatial data. And I'll come back to this if I get a chance. Like, that is opening up a whole new space we gotta talk about. So like those pieces, the first handful exists and everybody can do it. The last one, I'm like, I'm way hand waving, but it's coming fast.
Awesome, thank you. I want to take just a second because one of my concerns is, you know, a lot of us started, although today there's a lot more open source going on that I heard today than I thought was out there. But a lot of us started in a tiny dungeon of a geospatial shop in an agency that really didn't have a lot of faith in what we were doing. And I don't remember if it was Chris Holmes or Chris Tucker or somebody like that said to me once, geospatial is the lowest investment of any CIO's portfolio. Of any technology investment portfolio in government, geospatial is always the bottom rung of the ladder. We're last place, right? And I worry about that a lot because my narrative, my story is, you know, I got healthier and better when I went to open source. So do you guys have any advice for those who are at that moment, right? They want to preserve the few resources they have by investing in open source. Do you have any, I'll start with you, Chad. Do you have any advice of where you would start? And that could be anywhere, data, software, technology.
Yeah, it'd definitely be with software. So I think I told you about it a week or two ago. I saw a tech demo, a small company, very, very slick open source collection, display, analysis tool. It was pretty awesome. And, you know, I kind of tried to tease, like, okay, this is awesome. I think we're interested. You know, we're not going to talk money today. It's not that part of the discussion, but give me a sense of where this is. Is this a five-figure solution? Is it a six-figure solution? And there was some dancing and hemming and hawing, and eventually it became clear it was a seven-figure solution. And I was like, for seven figures, I would rather build, I'll hire, you know, three people and build it ourselves. Like, that's kind of the mentality, I think, for open source for me. The commercial software that's out there, it isn't exactly what I need, or it's very expensive, or it's both, and an open source solution that's sitting out there is probably a better option. And if it isn't, I'll take that $1 million and build it ourselves and add to it. I mean, that's kind of my philosophy on the question. Yeah.
Gotcha. Eric? Other than PostGIS, what else would you
do? Oh, sure, yeah. I'm going to attach myself to a comment once again that Chad made, right? I mean, I think we both came at this or have the history of it being high-end analysts who poked around and were code monkeys and have occasionally done really spectacular, fantastic things from there. And at various points in time, people have complimented us for stuff that we occasionally feel insecure about. But, you know, I enjoy, and this is nerding out, but this is the crowd for it, right? You know, just going to NGA isn't going to reinvent a lot of wheels, or they're not going to reinvent a lot of wheels quickly, right? But it's fun to play on GitHub, right? It's fun and it's sort of interesting to see how useful some people's codes are, because if you have a lot of contributors but nobody's using the code, is it really that valuable? But if you only have like three people contributing it, but you got 5,000 people that are pulling from it, there might be something there. What can you take from it? What can you use from it? What can you evolve from that and then use that and plug it in as a Lego or Tinker Toy into some of your analytical process to get further things out there? But, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there. Poke around, have fun, and feel free to move around.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's always, we can also, given time, come back to this build versus buy debate, right? And it's a necessary debate for government because you have to look at the tail of build, right? You can build your own software, but then you have to feed it and care for it forever. And buying software also has its pros and cons, and that's a worthwhile debate to have over a really good beer. So Dan, over to you. If you were advising a government office to get going, how would you assess that?
I'll be honest, I don't understand the question. Like, I feel like the question, how could you possibly justify not going open source if it meets your needs, right? Like, to the examples that Chad and Eric gave, where are you spending that money? Like, all right, real talk. If you're building it in-house, are you really building this amazing new platform that is unique to your specific needs? Or are you building yourself a mountain of technical debt that you're going to have to maintain? And it's not even just an ROI on like the developer costs that you're spending versus using an open source piece or whatever the solution is, but there's an opportunity cost. Like, is this really a way, does it allow you to procrastinate on solving the problem you are actually uniquely fit to solve? Like, your agency, your team, your group, whatever, like, it exists for a reason to solve a set of problems, and it is probably not to rebuild a foundational tool to process level zero to level two data. Like, there's something you're doing or you should be doing on the other side of that. And I think really having that conversation and looking at this as a how can I accelerate it, and I'll go back to what I said in the beginning about plugging in with kind of that influencer group back there, like and sub by plugging in with that group and figuring out where that's going, because there's a chance it's going in a different direction than you need it to go. Totally fair. At which point, reassess. I get that. But there's also a chance that it is going in a particular direction for a real reason that you haven't run into yet. And in particular, in this space, I'll make an argument here that, you know, 5 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, geospatial processing at the petabyte scale, satellite operations, downlinking data, building geospatial data lakes, was really the province of large agencies. Nobody else could afford to do it. And I would make an argument now that with the commercial space market having grown like it has, they don't operate in the billions of dollars. They operate in the like hundreds of millions. So it's an order of magnitude cheaper. That pressure, that financial constraint on that community has forced a sharing of solutions and has forced a set of standardization and a common use. It has moved that whole space in a way that I would argue hadn't happened before at least 5 years ago. And so if you're not looking into the open source space, whether it's for specifications or tooling or how to interoperate with other data lakes or interoperability, things along those, if you're not looking at those, you're missing a big industry shift that you really got to be plugged into and be aware of, and you're potentially rewriting a bunch of code that already exists, and you're going to miss the trends that move where things are going to speed you up on what you really need to be doing. I hope that didn't sound cranky.
So just to riff on that a little, you know, today we've seen a lot of open source software that's been deployed by various folks, much of it very impressive. Yeah, you guys, awesome. But we've also seen today, and you just described some of it in your corner of the world, but the stuff that we do beyond that, either building on open source or writing from scratch. And we end up with, at that point, GOTS, government off-the-shelf software that Uncle Sam built, basically, for our tax dollars. And I was chatting with ChatGPT the other day to learn some of the open source licensing models that are out there. And, you know, it occurred to me that GOTS is kind of a special case of open source that only you, the government, and us, the contractors that support you, really have access to. But then I got mad because I don't know where most of that stuff is. Like, you know, in the IC, it's behind a firewall. I can get to the stuff that's there. But I saw a lot of stuff today that's out there, and I've got some URLs written down. But I feel like if there's an important, well-placed government official here, we need like a GOTS hub scenario where it all has to go to this central shop where I can go there, shop for it, do my due diligence. I already do that in true OSINT off of GitHub. But what I don't see is in some of the stuff that's in a shoebox or other places. So, yeah, I mean, it all goes back, though, to I need something. Right. Is it already out there? I don't want to, I mean, most code's been written, despite what I said earlier about asking ChatGPT to write me more. It's been written. You just got to find it. And that due diligence before you go off and build it, we don't do that enough, I think. And if it was all sitting where I could find it easily, you know, I need a tool that does a certain thing, I'll bet Eric's built it. I just don't know where it is. And if I can find him, maybe I'll ask. But
so a geo-git for sponsored by the federal government for everyone. That seems like a good investment to me. Like,
yeah, I just wanted to chime in here also, just kind of piggybacking on these two guys. You know, I'm a fan, and, you know, a lot of times it's, we call it GOTS because we don't want the vendor to sell back stuff that we bought, paid for two or three times initially already. But, you know, the government needs to use more open source. The government also, when they're using open source, this is a personal rant, I'll stop in a second. When they're making edits, they should push it back. And then, God forbid, if they can't actually find it, maybe start with the project being open source and not be behind some version of a firewall, then other people can enhance it, tweak it, fix it, do whatever on there, right? So it's the sharing is caring aspect here, right? But, you know, a lot of times the government has does that ostrich thing, sticks their head in the hole, and is only looking at the one thing that they care about. But, you know, somebody else could be thinking something, per Dan's comment, 5 years down the road that then some PM isn't even embracing. So, you know, there is a huge value add there. You'd get better code. It would work faster. It would have be more scalable. And that would be a good thing. And then just throwing a plug out for NGA. It's a soft release now, but NGA even has an unclassified data lake. Need to have an NGA agreement. You need to have some relationship with NGA, but it's soft release now, getting announced next week, but it's stack with SageMaker and a bunch of stuff for industry and academia. Like, we want to play well with others as much as we can when the budget allows and we don't get yelled at.
You know, now that you mentioned that, there's also been a couple cases where NGA has gone all the way and open sourced that GOT, so it's open source in the full way. Yeah. That's a painful and expensive process sometimes to get the government to release it and open source it, but it's probably worth it. You open up the open source community that can access it and improve upon it.
Right. That is good when it happens. There's the legal discussion earlier was fascinating, because I've encountered this, right? And I talked with my brethren across DoD about there is no such thing as a good government software licensing model. All of them have shortcomings. And open source is really hard and not mature enough for software. Although it seems fundamental that that's exactly what we should develop because we are using taxpayer dollars. Let me switch to the last question. And I'll tell a quick another anecdote because I have to tell stories too. 2012 or so, we decided we would get into the AI business and did some great stuff with computer vision. Then we started playing with machine learning. We built a really cool tool. It took a while to get noticed and gain steam, but we finally got it out there. We got it accredited, which if you work in DoD, getting your stuff accredited and fielded onto a computer on a network is like the hardest thing to do. It can take 18 months. But we got it there, and then Deputy Director of National Intelligence, Neil Wiley, said to me, you know, we're going to look back on this moment in time where we just put AI out online for everybody using DoD, and in 5 years, this is going to seem really quaint. This is going to seem novel. The problem is, it's 8 years later, and it's still out there, and it still is one of the few things that we have out there. So what I really want to do is now look to the future, because we anticipate the steepness of this curve of technology coming, but in certain circumstances, I haven't realized it. I haven't seen that realized. So, Chad, I'll start with you, because we'll just keep the same order. Where do you see open source going in the next 3-5 years and beyond?
Yeah, so one thing that was said, I think it was in the legal and policy panel that I liked, which is it's AI, not geo-AI, which I definitely see that. I mean, I have 2.5 geography degrees, so everything should be geo to me. But I got that point. Ultimately, the AI is going to go there, and we, the people in this room, are going to have to figure out how to apply it to our problem sets, or maybe create a few custom use cases to it. But I feel like that is, an important distinction. And the reason I do think that, it's kind of a lead off to the answer, which is in 3 to 5 years, I think we're going to kind of see a cage match beyond Thunderdome. Two men enter, two people enter, one leaves. The big companies that are doing AI right now, Google and you know, Microsoft. One of those, maybe both of them, are going to really bring the AI tech stack that we're going to ride off of. And then it's a question of, you know, how we can bring Geo to the best. Remember in 2005-ish, Google entered the Geo game that went, you know, with Google Earth and Google Maps, and kind of disrupted. Google's in the picture for AI, obviously, but so is Microsoft. They're in the fight. So I think it'll be interesting. And as a technologist, I'll use them both. I'm promiscuous when it comes to the best tech. I'll use it all. So I think over the next 3 to 5 years, that fight will shake out. There's probably an underdog or three that I maybe have seen, but don't expect them to, you know, make a bigger impact. But I think that's going there.
Do you worry, though, because, you know, we see, and all due respect to those companies who I work with, we see them using that tech as a forcing function to their platform, right? And being interoperable across platforms is going to be a problem for our community. We may not have a choice in what we get to use.
Today. Yeah, it shouldn't be one or the other, especially for open sourcers like us. We want, you know, to not be reliant on one or the other. Right now, everything's kind of free, but, you know, there's definitely a pricing model coming for a lot of that stuff. But it does come down to the other thing that I you know, I don't know the answer, but I am watching carefully, and that is the proprietary commercial AI versus the open stuff. There's a lot of great stuff in, you know, the academic community mostly, but some companies are doing their AI in an open way that we can leverage off of for free. I mean, we'll pay for it in FTEs later. It's not free, but it free for a price tag. But I think those two things will be borne out over the next, you know, 3 to 5 years. AI, somewhere we had the Gartner curve. AI is in various places across the curve, but in terms of the big picture, I think it's still pretty early in the fight.
Right.
One last comment there on the Geo side of this. Did it go up? On the Geo side of it, if you aren't familiar with the Gartner hype cycle, it's the high curve up.
It was
and
up
then
earlier.
The trough of disillusionment, and then, you know, the tech settles into where it ultimately is. I think in Geo, we have been doing some really cool stuff on the pixel imagery side of the house for a long time. We're pretty far down the Gartner hype cycle. I think in the vector side, we are not. Here we go. It's up. So I think we're on the plateau of productivity in the raster side of it, where we're analyzing overhead imagery, ground photos for, you know, classification, extraction. We're pretty far down the curve in the raster side of AI, ML, in Geo. The vector side, we're still much earlier on. And if you're doing cool stuff with AI and vector space, I'd like to meet you at happy hour.
Eric, where do you see yourself in 5 years getting out of the trough of disillusionment?
First off, when Chad was saying Beyond Thunderdome, I was thinking of all of the CEOs from the companies dressed up in something from The Road Warrior and
Tina Turner.
Good
movie.
Great movie. Right, so two big things, and this is with the token Govy hat on, right? It's the earlier rant I had about open source. Use it, contribute back to it, and if you actually can't find it, maybe start off with it as much open source as possible and commit it back. And then the second one, this is the bigger foot stomp as Govy, interoperable. It needs to work, right? Because if we have an existing architecture, I'll say it, Esri, you know, there's a lot of Esri there, right? But if you can't pull it in with something that exists, or you need to gut and blow everything out and redesign everything, or it only works on a specific cloud platform, or you need a AWS compute system that costs $600 an hour to run concurrently on, you know, that can get problematic, right? So when you're bringing the data, when you're bringing the models, when you're bringing the tools in, you know, it could be cool, but it needs to work in the playground that we have, and then have an understanding of what the playground it is we have. That kind of goes back to my earlier comment of back in the day, I would say, well, your playground's stupid. You should change, but you know, it will change. It'll change slowly, but you have to meet us halfway.
Agree. I think I've thought about this interoperability question for years. Like, that's an area AI could really help us with, right? And I preach thin data models and let the AI train against your different data sets and learn, but we don't have enough of that. Let me switch over, because Dan hit on something. Yeah, sorry. Sorry? Okay, all right. Dan, take us home.
All right, I'll go real quick. So if you look at that Gartner curve right at the top, which is like peak of hyperinflation of expectations, like you can see me like jumping up and down. So I think there's two things I want to talk about real quick. So I'll go fast. One is hybrid space architecture. I think if you, so hybrid space architecture, meaning this blending of public data, private data, the ability to kind of chain advanced tipping and queuing, on-orbit processing, like putting all of these pieces together, like we're there. Like it's coming together now to be able to assemble that kind of thing. I'm going to start with a, you know, I get a RF data for a, you know, a beacon off a ship. I task a SAR constellation to get me see through the clouds, see this thing, high resolution optical on the other side. Like I you've got this whole flow of orchestration. I'm really excited about that. Jumping on the AI bandwagon though, I think the I don't think we have really, for as much as we've talked about it already so far, I don't think we've hit on the implications of large models. And I want to, like, just a question to throw out to the group, like, what is the responsibility, what is the obligation of an agency? Typically, you put out your level zero data, you put out your higher level data products. When do you put out a model? And do you still need the higher level data products? Can you put out a model? Can you rely on the model? Can you trust that model? Can you vet it? And I think, are we going to look back and say, like, hey, do you remember when there was a room full of analysts? And just like we say, hey, do you remember when we used to have our own data center and now we put it all in the cloud? And I'm done. I'm out. Yep.
Thank you guys very much. Thank you all very much for attending FedGeo Day 2024.